This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about AI and language. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Large language models are helping researchers gain new insights about language. For example, by digging through a priceless collection of hundreds of hours of recordings captured over the course of four decades. They were collected on the streets of Philadelphia to truly understand how spoken language changes, which happens much faster than what we can gather from studying written text. A linguistics pioneer started this work in the 1970s, and now a new generation of researchers is picking up where he left off. Grant Hill has more.
Joshua Plotkin is a biology professor at the University of Pennsylvania who uses mathematics to study biology, specifically how organisms evolve and what drives those changes. And he says those same mathematical models can be used to understand changes in vastly different settings.
It's just as interesting for me to study viruses evolving, which I do, or organisms evolving, but also culture and behavior evolving. And the mathematical models that the field has developed for understanding how viruses evolve could also be applied and are being applied to cultural evolution.
At the end of the day, change, no matter what kind, comes down to probability. And the more data you have to work with, the more accurate your analysis about that probability. That's what drew Joshua to study the evolution of language, the huge amounts of data captured within thousands of years' worth of writings and books. It was like a fossil record unlike anything that could ever be found in nature. And for that reason, people have been doing this kind of work since antiquity, using text to trace how new inventions and mass migrations influenced the development of words and grammar. Joshua thought his mathematical models could unlock new discoveries, hidden patterns and forces that quietly shaped the way we talk today. But when he told his linguist friends about the kinds of analyses he wanted to perform on this treasure trove of printed materials, they were not as excited.
Maybe that's interesting, but they kind of feel like, well, that's not really language. Language is like what we're doing right now. It's like, I'm talking, you're listening, you're talking, I'm listening.
Real language, they said, was spoken, not written down.
It's really complicated, it's messy, it's fast. And it's somehow effortless.
With language, change happens quickly and every day in countless casual interactions. Like when you first hear your new neighbor say sheesh when the trash isn't picked up yet. The next day, you catch yourself saying the same thing when your grocery store is out of your favorite yogurt. Or maybe it's pronunciation. A coworker says either, and now you say it this way instead of either.
And I thought, huh, how great would it be if we just had like some data set of some information about how spoken language has changed over time? That would be like a goldmine of really studying a real important cultural change.
And then Joshua discovered that this kind of goldmine did exist, just a 15-minute walk right across campus.
Right, so we have this whole bookshelf of all of these binders, and you can see each of them has, so if it says like PH737.
Meredith Taminga is a linguist at the University of Pennsylvania and keeper of the Philadelphia Neighborhood Corpus, a collection of over 400 recordings of everyday Philadelphians taken over the course of four decades, from 1972 until 2012.
When I was a grad student, all of this material lived in its hard form in the tape closet. And at the time, Bill's lab was this old Victorian house. And I just lived in fear of the building burning down because it was the only copies of all of these recordings from, like, you know, this epic span in the history of sociolinguistics.
The project was the brainchild of Meredith's longtime mentor, William or Bill LeBove. Here he is speaking at a virtual award ceremony 3 years ago.
I entered linguistics at the age of 33. I'd worked for 10 years as an industrial chemist, and I brought with me the habits of numerical recording.
In 1961, LeBove quit his job as a chemist to go back to school at Columbia University and, as he put it, enter into the pursuit of the universal properties of human language.
There I found that linguistics had a very different mode of gathering data. Asking somebody, can you say this?
When Lebove entered the field, linguists had already begun to turn away from studying written language and toward fieldwork on spoken language, probing real people about how they talked. Here's Meredith again.
The field worker would go and they would try to find representative people in a little village. And they would be like, get me your oldest farmer dude. And then they would be like, here's my word list. And it's all, you know, sort of like farm implement terms. Like, well, how do you, you know, what do you call this kind of plow? What do you call that kind of plow?
Bill Lebove saw two problems with this methodology. First was all the note-taking.
It occurred to me that the field could profit by the adoption of this new invention, the tape recorder, and preserve what people actually did say.
If you could record people as they talked, you could later measure the sound waves they produced and capture a whole new form of data. Data that can be analyzed to determine the exact placement of a speaker's tongue when they talked. Still, Lebove knew these data points would be useless if you couldn't find a solution to the other problem, the fact that being prompted and observed by a researcher changes how people talk. They might feel self-conscious, use different words, or try to hide regional accents. So Lebove wanted to accomplish a new level of observation, record people's everyday language while somehow making them comfortable enough to not think about that language they used. And his early work reared revolutionary results. For the first time, Lebove was able to show how class and social attitudes influenced single words, phrases, and even pronunciations. This might seem obvious now, but Lebove put numbers behind it. He could quantify these pressures, measure their impact on how people said certain vowels. But eventually, he wanted to take this work one step further, to capture how these expressions change over time. To accomplish all of this, he started a brand new linguistics class at Penn called Ling 560. Meredith took it as a graduate student.
This class is really like no other class that I've ever taken.
It was a year long, and the assignments were strange. Students had to team up in groups of four or five and find a single city block in Philadelphia, one with parking only on one side of the street.
These were the blocks where people are sort of physically closer together.
Fertile ground for interaction and language exchange. The students would draw pictures of the blocks they chose, really study them, all while trying to go relatively unnoticed.
One thing that Bill would sort of teach you to do was don't go out there in your Penn sweatshirt. Try to dress like a normal person.
Then, one by one, the students introduced themselves to the neighborhood.
Hi, I'm a researcher and I'm from Penn and I have a microphone. Can I record you?
They didn't mention that they were doing a study on language. They'd ask about demographic information, people's history on the block, questions about childhood games, and even whether or not people had ever gotten into fights.
The themes were designed to be things that people sort of found interesting to talk about or would get engaged in speaking about.
I started out as a sales girl and got demoted to the stockroom.
This went on for 40 years, as Bill Lebove sent generations of grad students all across Philadelphia, getting people to open up, be genuine.
You know, they had a sale, I'll never forget one day, and I made $116 and they took it away from me and they gave it to this old sales lady because I was called a contingent in the store. And I was so mad and I hollered and screamed and yelled and they demoted me to the stockroom.
People have shared intimate details about their lives, their fears. And that's why, at least for now, not many researchers have access to these tapes. One of the chosen few is Joshua Plotkin, the biology professor whose office is only a few minutes across campus.
They have 400 different recordings of different speakers, encompassing on the order of 2 million words uttered.
When he found this data goldmine next door, he started reading Lebove's analysis and conclusions. Lebove's researchers had transcribed all of the audio recordings by hand, matched words with sound waves, and charted the exact position of people's tongues as they made these specific sounds. And this work led to new observations.
It discovered that certain vowels changed their pronunciation really dramatically over the course of 100 years.
Think water and water, high school and high school. But Joshua noticed something different, that frequently people changed how they pronounced the same words in the course of a single conversation. For example, in a recording of an interview with a woman born in 1952.
In the middle of her conversation, she says, "There's always crowds of people because I work 7:30 to 3. She actually pronounced that word work, moving her tongue forward a tiny bit compared to most pronunciations that she herself made elsewhere in the conversations. There's many, many tens of thousands of other utterances of the vowel phoneme And you can see how she might modulate her pronunciation of in work in one context versus another.
Why was this speaker suddenly changing how she pronounced the word work from one sentence to the next? Randomness wasn't to blame. This was a systematic thing. Something seemed to push pronunciations back and forth.
And so for me, like, the most simple hypothesis, because I'm not a linguist, like, the most idiotic hypothesis is that one reason why you might want to pronounce things in a certain way is to avoid miscommunication. I want to pronounce things in a way so that even in the context of a conversation, you're not going to be confused that I meant some other word. And so we would expect that, you know, from instance to instance, people would choose, or maybe even subconsciously, I guess choose isn't the right word, just subconsciously modulate their sound production to avoid miscommunication.
But now, Josh needed a way to evaluate this hypothesis.
And to begin to study that, we have to know, well, what's the chance that when she says work in a certain way, what's the chance that a listener would hear some other word?
Words like wake or walk. Short words that start with a W, sound somewhat similar to work, and given the context, could plausibly be used in that sentence too. This is where ChatGPT comes into play.
And what GPT tells us is the likelihood, given the sentence structure, there's always crowds of people because I work 7:30 to 3. GPT tells us the likelihood of all those alternative words, and it turns out that work is actually the most likely word, the one that she actually uttered, but walk is also pretty likely. It's about half as likely as work.
So it's possible that the speaker made a subconscious effort to be extra clear when she said work, as if those same calculations Joshua saw happening under the hood of ChatGPT were also happening somewhere in the deep recesses of this person's brain.
Moving her tongue forward actually moves it away from the ah and ah. So she's definitely kind of, at least in this case, right, her pronunciation of the word work, her production of that sound was, it's as if subconsciously, she was moving her vowel phoneme away from the only other word that might have been confusing there, walk, kind of subconsciously making herself more understandable and less likely for the listener to misunderstand it as walk.
Joshua is still in the beginning stages of his research. This example could just be a fluke.
But if we see the same thing happening, you know, over 1 million instances, then we start to think, okay, actually, there is a pressure to modulate your production of sound, even subconsciously, to avoid miscommunication. Like, that's like the kind of research we want to do.
And with the help of ChatGPT digging through these archives, he can do this research, and much more quickly than ever before. For The Pulse, I'm Grant Hill.